Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you're listening to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. This time, my guests on the show are British 49er Olympic campaigners Dylan Fletcher and Stuart Biffle. Now, the glamorous lifestyle of Olympic campaigning is often described as living the dream. And if ever there were two people whose lives match up to that description, it's Dylan and Stu. As well as winning the 49er World Championship in 2017 and being one of the hot favourites to represent Great Britain at Tokyo 2020, this dynamic duo are also a key part of the British Sail GP crew, with Dylan on the wheel and Stu in the role of flight controller. I caught up with the two of them on the Mediterranean island of Mallorca, where they just arrived for a month of training ahead of the Olympic classes Princess Sofia Trophy Regatta at the beginning of April. So Stuart Biffle, Dylan Fletcher, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I wanted to start by talking to you about this kind of quite remarkable lifestyle you guys are leading right now. We're talking right now in Mallorca, the yacht club in Arenal, where you're here for the Princess Sofia Trophy, which is in a couple of weeks' time, I think. You began the year with another 49er event in Miami as part of the World Sailing World Series. And then you hightailed it down to Australia for Sail GP. That sounds pretty glamorous. It's quite a lifestyle, isn't it, Dylan?
Yeah, we were, funnily enough, we were sailing around the other day. We'd got back from Sydney and we had a fantastic event, you know, with the team in Sydney. And we landed on Monday. Tuesday I was moss sailing in that sunny weather we had back in the UK. And Wednesday we were out in the 49er and it was 20 knots in February, 12 degrees. We were sailing around and I was like, we are some of the luckiest people in the world, you know, we are just, how have we got to where we've got to? And it was, you know, we're incredibly lucky, and I guess just testament to if you just pushing in our passion, and yeah, absolutely love it.
And Stu, from your point of view, you've come a long way from Hollingworth Lake and GPs when I first met you.
Yeah, I mean, I often think about that, you know, coming just from a small sailing club up north of England, to racing around in these super foiling machines at Sydney Harbour.
Was that always a dream for you to do this, or is this something that's kind of evolved as it's gone on?
Yeah, it's certainly evolved for me, you know, as a nipper, you know, the Olympics was the big goal, and going there and, you know, endless amounts of dreams about winning gold medals, sailing, you know, the best people, sailors in the world in the Olympic classes. So, you know, you can't deny that, you know, we're a bit older now, and over those years, so like your 20s to 30s, you have, well, what next, you know, what's the big plan in the long term? And that certainly looked towards professional sailing, the best circuits out there, and to be honest, circuits where you can actually get paid rather than hemorrhaging cash down a set of 49er sails and boats. And so yeah, a long way from Rochdale, that's for sure.
So this pace that you're living at right now, it looks like it's going to continue for the rest of the season. Dylan, can you just kind of talk us through the highlights of the year coming up for you now?
Yeah, so going forward, we've got a bit of time in terms of the 50 until we next get back into that, so we're really concentrating at the moment, focusing on the 49er. That's why we're out here in, you know, glamorous Palma and getting some amazing training in. And then we're moving forward, we've got Princess Sofia, and then we've got a couple of weeks training in Weymouth, and then we're straight out to San Francisco for the next round of the Sail GP circuit. And we're looking forward to San Fran. Obviously it's going to be different to Sydney, should be a bit steadier, and obviously we've got a lot of wind and tide to contend with, so I guess it'll be the first time that we get sort of multiple days in big breeze, and fingers crossed that, you know, we break that 50 knots, which has been obviously talked about a lot, that what these boats are capable of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's I think if you're ever going to do it, San Francisco could be the place to do it. So listen, on the Olympic side of things, talk a little bit about how you organise yourself, because I'm imagining there must be a lot of flights to be booked, ferries to be booked, you need to get your boat around the world. Are you operating one boat? Do you have two boats? Like, how does the logistics of all this work?
Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, obviously we're part of the British sailing team, and they have support staff in there that do help facilitate a lot of the booking of stuff and getting containers around the world. Dylan and myself, we've got three 49ers currently, As a general rule, one of them's in a container at some point. And then there's obviously, we have a race boat, and in fact we've got kind of got two race boats. We don't really have a training boat at the minute. We've all got good kit, so yeah, it is quite a logistical nightmare, but there is support with that. And yeah, to be honest, Dylan's really good and efficient at it.
I was going to say,
I'm guessing
one of you must be the organiser. Is that you, Dylan?
Well, I do most, I do a bit of the, you know, organising and boat work and stuff, but you know, we get some amazing help from our parents. So, you know, occasionally, you know, Stu's dad's been driving our boat round to different venues, which is fantastic because of, you know, we don't get many days off, and you know, every day is valuable. So it's great to have that. And yeah, the biggest thing for us is the, you know, the professionalism with it, and it's something we've obviously learned a little bit from SailGP, and is that, you know, you always have all your race boats need to be all the same, always ready, all the time, and so. I think that's something that we've worked hard on, and it's a strength of ours.
How many days a year are you on the water actually sailing, would you say?
That's a good question. I think I'm probably on the water more than most. So we got back from, so we were 2 weeks in Miami and then 2 weeks in Sydney. And then the week after I got home from Sydney, I'd done 6 days sailing out of seven. So I don't know, I mean, 300, 250, between 250 and 300 probably days a year.
Now, it was a question I was going to ask you further down the list of questions, but you guys are doing so much sailing, and I get it. You know, it's a dream lifestyle for a lot of people, me included. But do you still enjoy it? Do you still get a kick out of going on the water?
100%. You know, if you didn't, you wouldn't do it. I think the thing for me and Dylan is we're so organised, and we have clear goals what we're trying to achieve, and that's always driving us. We've got clear goals with the Olympics in the 49er. We've got clear goals in the F50 to one day dominate that circuit. So, you know, if you was just going out there sailing around, it wouldn't be that motivating. But because we're so passionate and organised and driven by what we're trying to achieve, it's actually quite easy.
are there good days and bad days?
Oh yeah, you always get good days and bad days. You know, we saw like the in the SailGP in Sydney. You know, we had some lots of good times of racing, but then sometimes some bad times. You know, jibing or like locked out at the start. You know, but I think that something is a strength of ours is no matter how good or bad a day's been, just remaining the same. You know, we had a difficult season last year for us in the 49er, and we still, you know, kept pushing, and even though we're having bad events, we were still in the top 10, still, you know, hunting around. And Miami was a very tricky week for everyone involved, and you know, to come away with a silver medal there was, we really felt like we ground it out. You know, it was a solid performance.
I've heard it said, in fact it was Ian Walker, who's now the racing manager at the RYA, as you guys well know. Ian, when he was skipping his Volvo Ocean Race team, said you can judge a team not when it's doing well, but when it's doing badly, how it reacts to doing badly. And you mentioned you had a difficult season, having won the Worlds the previous season. How do you kind of cope with that? How do you deal with that? Because I'm sure you would have wanted to dominate that season as well.
Yeah, I guess you know you get to the end of your year, whenever that may be, usually autumn for us after the European circuit and World Championships and stuff. You start planning again for the next year, and certainly for us this year we. You know, we there was areas in our campaign which we'd lost a little bit of control and not quite going the way we thought. And it's not making excuses because, you know, we're still driving our campaign and we're always the ones in charge. But, you know, certainly we have had some good learning points. And it's a touchy subject, but it is quite tricky to do what you want in the British sailing team system. You know, we're coming up to the tapered end of the campaign, and you know, sharing coaches and the support that's available. Don't get me wrong, it's very good, but it is quite a tricky subject. So me and Dylan looked at it from last year and gone, we're taking a little bit more control back, getting the people around us that we need to support us to get better. And, you know, we're still looking to get better and better because we know that when the gold medalists come back in the Kiwi team, they will be a strong team and we want to beat them. Yeah. So we have to keep pushing forwards.
I think, and also we've just in reality we've got ourselves in a difficult financial situation, and we didn't have any kit last year, and it was a, you know, with hindsight we could have bought more kit, but we kind of convinced ourselves that the kit we had and that was good enough, and in reality it was all a bit old and not maybe the, exactly what we needed. And you know, in reality now with Sail GP, we didn't have a sponsor, we won the world championship, still had no sponsor, still firing into debt, and now we've got some money coming in, we can actually afford to campaign at our 49 at the appropriate level that's required.
So that funding, so basically what you're being paid for Sail GP is helping to fund your Olympic campaign, is that what you're saying?
All the money from Sail GP just goes straight into our 49er campaign, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a bit of backdating debt there. So.
Yeah, I'm
sure. A bit of debt, yeah.
What, I mean, as a rough figure, what does it cost for you in a season to campaign a 49er properly at that level?
That's a good question. I guess on the equipment side, you're probably looking at 30-40 grand a year on equipment, like sort of it, that's taken into account depreciation, so obviously you spend more than that, but you resell some kit, and then you know we're lucky that with this RWA system the coaching's paid for, but I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, but it's a lot of money, but then again it's a lot less than the service costs per event. So and I think something we've looked at is, you know, we looked at Pete and Blair obviously a lot. They were dominant for 4 years and won the gold medal, and that's obviously the way you want to do it. And we were like, right, what are they doing? How are they campaigning? And what can we learn from them, and learn from Nathan, and learn from Giles? And you see the professionalism and the sort of, you know, not having small things like, why do you have a training boat and a racing boat? You should just have race boats. You know, ideally you're training on good kit because it feels the same as your race kit. You know, and all those sorts of small details add up.
You're replacing sails a lot during the season, I guess. Is it new sails for each regatta?
It's not necessarily new sails for each regatta. It's more like trying to ensure that we've got good sails for the whole year and have got enough good sails. You know, that the we sail a one design class, but like, you know, there's always a build tolerance, and at our level there's always small differences, and you try to ensure that you're not necessarily exploiting them, but you have a consistency. You've got one main that might be slightly different, but so ideally if that's your good one that you feel comfortable with, you want another one that's similar, you know. So we try and, you know, buy quite a few mainsails and keep the quick ones for us. But it's once the beauty of that is that what we might think is quick, someone else would think is slow. So there isn't just one quick setup, and we found that from within our squad. We've swapped boats, and we've swapped, you know, you swap around, and rarely does everyone, you know, think the same thing. Most people have a preference, oh, that was the quickest one, or that was the best one. And so actually, that's kind of the beauty of the squad, is something we've learned, is that there is no right answer. There's just what suits your style. And
I like that. I like the idea there's a style to how you sail the boat. So when you watch, if you watch a bunch of 49ers, the top guys racing, can you kind of, would you be able to identify them even if you couldn't see the sailing signatures and stuff? You can see how, like, kind of how their body language is and that sort of stuff?
Probably, yeah.
I reckon I could recognise most boats from a rig shot if you covered everything up, yeah. at least the top, you know, 10, if you showed me a rig shot in a certain amount of breeze, I could probably tell you who it is.
Right. That's really interesting. So not even the people, but just the way they set the boats up.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So it's really about how you sail these boats rather than a magic bullet of, you know, this is how you do it. And
oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. You know, I think that you see that, you know, Pete and Blair obviously dominated last cycle, and I'm sure they probably would have won a gold medal if you'd put them in a few different people's kit. They were just obviously a very strong team and were sailing the boat well. You know.
Now, you mentioned coaching as part of the RYA stuff. Just talk a little bit about your coach, introduce him to us, and tell us what he adds to the whole thing. I should add, he's sitting here in this meeting.
Well, I mean, we've got one of our good friends who we grew up racing 29ers with. Well, I didn't personally, but he's a great youth sailor. He's come out here to support just me and Dylan.
Tell us his name.
Ed Clayson.
I bought my first ever boat from Ed when I was 13 years old.
Yeah, it's a Swiss lad to call him Little Ed. No, but he's, you know, he comes out on the water, always getting rig shots, always making sure we're working well as a team. And something that, you know, me and Dill identified was that, actually, that little bit of personal support when we're out sailing, make sure we're extremely efficient when we're out on the water. And Ed brings that, We also got other coaches that, you know, coming in to help with slightly different areas of our campaign. And
I think something we're maybe slightly different from other people's certainly the majority of campaigns, but not all, is that we don't have a head coach. We sort of run our campaign, and then we bring in sort of the coaches that we feel we need at the right point because of their expertise.
What might differ between those coaches, what they focus on? Would it be like a tactics coach or a...
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's going to be a coach that's really good at making the boat go fast. There's going to be one that's really good at delivering support in regattas. And so, yeah, there might be a few coaches out there that think they've got it all, but they haven't. So, yeah, it's just using each person's strength, if you like, and then hopefully soaking that out, which would then make me and Dylan the best sailors in the, you know.
Okay.
Joking. Yeah. Sarcasm.
So you guys chose your coach, and you've worked together for how long now?
Ed's done a couple of camps with us now, and again, I guess we don't really have a head coach sort of anymore, so we've... Since last year, we've been working with 3-4 different coaches. And yeah, I guess that is something we can't really put a timescale on it, because we don't have that sort of overlying head coach. Different.
So his interaction with you in a given day, what might that look like? Say a day when you're not at a regatta, but a day like today, maybe when you're going to train, from when you first speak in the morning, what's he telling you? What's the input?
Yeah, so obviously we've got goals for this next period, as in roughly a month. So Ed will, from those goals, set out the morning briefing, what we're going to achieve today. There's some quite specific things in there, holding us accountable to make sure we go out and do that. Like almost running a day, if you like. Mm-hmm.
Running the day, keeping us honest.
Yeah,
I think that's the main thing. Though sometimes you can either get, think you've had a really good day and maybe you weren't actually as good as you thought, or the flip side is you're a bit harsh on yourself and actually you were winning most of the races or something. I think that's something that Ed's really good at. Keeping us honest and ensuring that we're working well together and we're picking up on the important parts of each day.
A bit like when you go to the gym on your own or you go with a personal trainer, you can think you're doing the same stuff, but you work harder with the personal trainer there.
Exactly that, yeah.
Okay. And I think a lot of that, though, is also we've learned a lot from the Sale GP and the level of the work ethic. And, we're pulling 12, 13-hour days every single day we're in Sydney, and that's not something that you do often in Olympic sailing. And so I think we've brought some of that level of professionalism, and it's always with a pinch of salt because of the time scales of you're doing it for a lot longer than the Olympics, and you've got to keep that motivation, you've got to keep that hunger. But there's always more you can do. You can work harder, be more efficient, more productive.
So let's talk about that Sale GP experience. You guys are the core of the British Sale GP campaign. It's led by Chris Draper, who's another 49er sailor who would be very well known to you, I guess. How did that all come about? Did he pick you, or were you picked by the organisation, or how did it all work?
So I got a phone call off Russell last year. I can't even remember when it was. May, June? I can't remember. But I got a phone call off Russell saying, just wanting to talk to me, was it something I was interested in? I'd heard rumours of it, and...
Is this a common experience, Russell, just gives you a call?
Yeah, I was quite excited, I'm not going to lie. When I had this phone call, I was like, oh my God, this is Russell Coutts is like, wants to speak to me, you know?
Did you think for a minute it might have been Stu pretending to be Russell?
Oh yeah, that would have been that would be a good prank. Wouldn't put it past him. We have a few pranks going around our camp. I mean, so yeah, so I had a phone call with him, and then went and met him in London, and he obviously chose to get Chris involved as a CEO, and that was, from our point of view, when we initially talked to Russell, the biggest potential problem was that I didn't think we could run it, you know, either of us or together or on our own, that it's just too much to do. We've got an Olympic campaign to focus on, and having Chris there as someone who's done it all before is incredible and allows us the opportunity to still focus on our Olympic campaign whilst being involved in Sale GP.
And for you, Stu, how excited were you to...
Well, it was a bit of a weird one for me, to be honest. Obviously, You know, Dil was in the conversations with the bosses, if you like. Dil was very honest. He was always open. He's like, mate, if we're going, and, you know, you're coming with me, kind of thing. So that was extremely exciting. But I was kind of on the don't forget me, Dil.
we always came as a package. I just felt a bit more pressure to make sure I didn't screw it up, because it was a good opportunity, for, obviously, for both of us. And looking back on it now, we ummed and ahed at times, and we had some difficult conversations, and had to reassure the RAA management that we would be able to deliver on our promise in the Olympic campaign. It was a no-brainer looking back on it. You know, it's just been a fantastic experience, and being on that learning curve, sailing with Chris Draper, and sailing against some of the best sailors again in the world. You're just constantly learning.
Yeah, and that step up for you to be steering about that size, from your moving from your Moth and your 49er with Stu, that seems to me to be a huge leap. Was that a daunting prospect for you?
So basically, to put it into perspective, I've pretty much never helmed or raced, like skippered a boat, anything other than 49er and Moth. I hadn't raced a TP, I haven't raced a, haven't helmed a Melges 24, I haven't even helmed a J17, literally, you know, none of that. I've just concentrated on Olympic sailing and a bit of Moth sailing, and I never forget, we're in New Zealand for training, and it's day one, we're heading out, and Chris is like, yeah, if you just direct everyone with what you want to do to leave the dock, and we've got this 50-foot $8 million catamaran and this small exit of the harbour we're getting to, and he's like, yeah, if you just tell them what to do, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Maybe you'd like to step in at that point.
And Chris is good. Chris, you know, held my hand a bit and helped me with it. But it's like anything, you grow into it. And now we've got confidence. We know what we're doing most of the time.
If that was a big step up for you, Stu, moving from dangling from a trapeze wire with a sheet in your hand to flight controlling the boat with what I'm guessing is an array of buttons and a joystick, that's another big step as well. Right? How did you make that move?
Huge step. You know, there's no doubt the few years I've done Mothin has been a massive help, just to gain some foiling experience and learning how foils work and stuff. But yeah, huge jump. But the team around us and the learning and the, you know, making it easy to learn, a good environment to learn, has been brilliant. And you know, don't get me wrong, there's still a hell of a lot to learn, but yeah, start to know what the buttons mean.
Because it's not, I imagine it can't be an intuitive thing, because you're using a joystick and some buttons to control the flight of this boat. You are really learning on the job, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bit. Like you say flight controller, but currently the boats are set up in a way where it's much easier for the helmsman to do it from the twist grip on the steering wheel. So actually in our boat at the minute, Dylan is primarily the flight controller.
Okay.
Until it comes to manoeuvres, and then obviously I get involved with the joystick. But yeah, there's no set rules, basically. They're currently developing a slightly better system for the joystick, which could make it easier for the intended plan for the flight controller to control the boat. So we'll see. It's all moving on.
It's a big change, isn't it, in terms of though from the 49er, because in the 49er, Stu kind of makes a boat go fast, and I kind of make decisions. Obviously, we have conversations and help each other out. Whereas in the 50, it's a flip side of, you know, I'm sort of steering and trying to make the boat go fast, and Stu's telling me where to go. And it's very interesting that it's like it's the same as the 49er, just the other way around. But actually, you know, the comms are the same, and it's really similar, and it's good that we sort of bring that teamwork into it, and it's something that we're very strong with. And Stu, you know, did an amazing job of picking up this sort of different style of racing and going this fast. And it's, you know, it is full on when you've got a crop, you're trying to call a cross in these $8 million race boats, and it's a bit higher consequence, you know.
Yeah, it just boggles my mind completely, and I don't think we see that as clearly on the TV as you guys experience it. We're still not quite there in terms of transmitting or communicating that experience. But that first day that you guys went sailing on the boat, I guess it was probably back in December last year down in New Zealand, and you popped up on the foils and took off to whatever speed it was. What did that feel like?
It was quite funny. Yeah, we literally sailed out the harbour and we were very safe and slow when we were exiting harbour. It was quite narrow, and then it was like, right, pop it on the foils. And yeah, I just was like, well, I'm just twist this grip and expect the boat's going to lift out of the water, and then I'll just hope that my brain knows what to do. You know, and there was a few times where I'd go to head up, and I also needed to do something with the twist grip, but then did the wrong thing with the twist grip because, you know, just trying to tap your head and rub your belly and all that. So trying to get used to it. But it was an incredible feeling. The boats are amazing, and 30 knots doesn't feel that bad or that fast. But then when you get to 40 and 45, it starts getting full noise, you know?
Yeah. I think it's worth saying as well, like, we spent a bit of time before that moment in a world-class simulator in London.
Yeah.
And also everyone on the boat has been through, like, safety training, and so they're very conscious of making us prepared as we can be. But there's certainly no doubt that first time when Drape was like, right, pop it up, Dil. It's like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, and off it went. And you're right, they have given you the opportunity to be as prepared as you can be, given the time. But still, I think one of the exciting things about this is most of the teams are all learning these boats as they go. I mean, a couple of them, like Nathan's boys, have done a lot more of it, and it clearly shows. But that's exciting, isn't it, to be in a new class and to be learning how to make it all work.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what I find exciting is in Sydney we were racing around with those guys already.
Yeah,
you know, and that as a team, that's like, I think that's really impressive. And I know it was light winds and maybe a little bit easier, but it's really cool to be that, you know, already having a race with them. You know, if someone did that in a 49er or a 470 or laser, you wouldn't be racing the best guys in the world for at least 2 years.
No, that's right.
But I think that, you know, the series, they've got a lot of things in place. For example, all the data off all the boats is available to everyone, which is really accelerating the newer teams' learning. So it will be very soon. It will be a matter of who's the best sailors, which is the best nation,
who's sailing the best on that day.
Exactly. You
know. And from that data, I'm really interested in that because that is something that's new and different. And I'm searching for that in this series that's going to redefine sailing. What can you get from that data? I mean, what do you get? You get a spreadsheet or you get a...
So effectively, I don't actually know where the data is, but the data probably exists in the cloud because that's where most things live nowadays. You know?
That's always my answer to everything.
So the data is somewhere, and you can have a data analyst, maybe they're saying that, who can access that and put it through their own software that some people have, or there's a bit of software called Grafana, which is what they sort of use for us to look at it. And effectively, it's almost a case of, well, there's all the data, and you've got to decide that the skill is which parts of the data are important and how are you going to choose to interpret that. And you've got all these squiggly lines and you've got all these different numbers, and so it's really interesting. It fascinates me. I love all that stuff, and I love looking at the numbers and looking at the data, and I'm a bit of a geek and a weirdo when it comes to that. And we, interestingly, didn't have someone analysing for us in Sydney because just due to the nature of like a budget and what we felt like was important. But going forward, we will do, and I think that you see it. You see on the data, you can just see the improvements, or like, oh, look, there's the Japanese are trying this, or the Aussies are doing this differently, and we've got all this list of things that next time we go to San Fran, we're going to be doing this differently because the top two boats are doing it. And I think that is huge. You know, they can't go and do something without us seeing it. You know, if they're using a different drop mode, we know about it. You know, and a lot of the time, in reality, the mistakes we're making are down to a more basic level of, well, were we flying stably, and where did we have the boat flat? Yeah. In reality, that was a bigger issue than other things. But once you progress past that, you know, you can then see the other parts of it.
It was pretty light winds in Sydney, and you could say that would make it easier for you, but it also makes it a bit harder to stay on the foils through the jibes, which we saw a lot of, and that's where the big gains and losses came. Mm. That's where the fleet spread out. But you guys finished third in the event overall, and I heard some commentary from the boat about you know, we're always overtaking boats until we come to jibe, which, you know, I think is very honest and very fair. So did you come away from that feeling like once we learn how to jive, we're going to be pretty competitive?
Yeah, I mean, we were really happy with how we were starting, really happy with the boat speed. The handling was one of the biggest things that was tripping us up.
Did you know that going into it? Did you know that was your...
We was aware that, the whole training period, we were trying to improve our handling, different conditions, trying to improve it all the time. Yeah. That was the main goal, to the extent where we didn't really do any practice starts until the practice race.
Yeah,
that was certainly different as well. We'd never done reaching starts in our lives, and it was like, so reaching start, lads, here you go. It's like, okay. Yeah. So we were pretty happy that it turned out to be normally a strength of ours. But the progression made over the day one to day two of racing on our driving was massive. And I think you're right. And if we feel as though we were super proud of the team as to how we worked. You know, we talked about being fast learners, and we were. And I do think that, I hope at least, that in San Fran we will be, we might, be able to win a race and be fighting it out with those top two boats. And for sure, the breeze brings about, I guess, more elements of danger and speed. But the boats do become, like, jibing. We had no problems jibing when it was windy. It's just easy. It's the same as a mock. Jibing is much easier. But then tacking becomes a little bit harder, because if you do a foil tack, it's then a big gain, whereas it was almost too light to foil tack. And I think that with the changes made to the boats, I wouldn't be surprised. I know it's floated around, but if you do see the old 100% fly time from boats in San Fran, and that's what I think. I think you might see dry laps.
Wow. Okay. So top speed on the F50 so far has been what?
46 knots.
46.
15 knots of wind. Trying to take it easy.
yeah. Not foiling too high, not too much diff, just.
Wow, that's mind-blowing. When you jump back in the 49er after that, does it feel...
It feels like everything's slow motion.
Right.
Yeah,
but that's got to be good for you.
Yeah, I think it is.
100%. We were sailing in the other day in Weymouth. It was like 20 knots, 25 knots or something, and we had a big skid out, got hit by a massive gush, rounded up, and we were just laughing, nearly capsized. Going as quick as a 49er ever goes, and we're just laughing because you're like, oh yeah, sweet, that was quite funny, wasn't it? We just relaxed, I think that's random, but I was watching Free Solo last night and watching a guy who's, I can't remember his name, Alex, who's got no fear, and you just see him so calculated because fear isn't getting in the way of what he's doing.
What's that? What was that though?
Free Solo, it's a climbing film about, I can't remember his second name, but he climbs this mountain in Yosemite, El Capitan, and he free solos the whole thing, 3,000 foot, and it is just mind-boggling, the whole thing. But he has, and they checked his, did an MRI on his brain, and his fear part of his brain just doesn't fire very much. He needs a massive stimulus.
Right. And I completely understand where you're going with that, because I've interviewed Thomas Cavill and Francois Gabart, and we talked about this kind of league of incredible sportsmen, like the climbers, and because these guys are sailing these ultim boats at ridiculous speeds day and night, sleeping for 6 minutes, and it's there has to be something different going on in their brains that isn't stopping them from just...
They're not right.
They're not, you could say they're just not right in the head, maybe.
Tup and show the shoes.
Exactly. Well, listen, let's just ask one final question. I could talk to you all day, quite honestly, but I know you've got to go sailing. We talked at the beginning of the interview, you're living this dream lifestyle, but you're spending a huge amount of time together. It's 300 days on the water for you, and so you must be together for the large percentage of the year. Do you ever get on each other's nerves?
Oh, yeah. Daily.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally, but we're a strong team. We understand, I guess, a bit of age and wisdom. You understand sort of the differences in each other, and actually when you need... We understand, I guess, time off. It's really important to have time off and time apart, but we're lucky. He's an all right lad. He's got a good sense of humour too, so it makes up for my lack of...
I've always found him quite quiet and introverted, to be honest. Any thoughts from you, Stu?
Yeah, no, it's... What did it? I can't remember who said it, but of course, it's like a marriage without love. So, we have to get on. We go through hard times, we go through easy times, but you know, we have our little techniques to bounce back, a bit of time off, and I think we're both grounded and genuinely appreciate the opportunity that we've been given. So I think that goes a long way. Like, we are so lucky. Like, if we're having a bad day, think of the, you know, some poor guy at home that's, you know, doing a job that he doesn't particularly enjoy. Or
can you imagine what you might both have been doing if you hadn't gone down this route? I can't imagine either of you doing anything else, but what might it have been?
I'm just thinking about that quote that Peter Crouch said. What would you be if you weren't a footballer? A virgin.
I don't know. I always wanted to be a Formula One driver, but I know I wouldn't be one. But if I wasn't doing this, I'd probably be in a city, even some investment banker, you know, being really annoying and dealing with risk and all, you know, similar thing, decision making, love it.
Just doing less sailing every year, but
clear view, but certainly something in sport. I love sport,
So
it'd be something involved with that.
You said it's a marriage without love, but there must be a lot of respect between the two of you. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, you can't have a relationship without a huge amount of trust and respect, you know, and I think that's something that we're really good at, and it's all about getting the best out of each other. And if I do my job really well and Stu does his job really well, then we'll achieve what we want.
Yeah, we often joke around that, like, you make me look good, now I'll make you look good.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, if we're quick, then it's pretty easy to be good at tactics, and if you're good at tactics, it's pretty easy to be quick.
Absolutely. Well, that's probably a good place to end it. Stu and Dylan, thank you so much for talking to me. It's, I think, a great episode of the podcast, and good luck for the rest of the season and for the campaign for Tokyo.
Thanks so much.
Cheers, Justin.
Cheers.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. So thanks to my guests Dylan Fletcher and Stuart Biffle for taking the time to sit down and talk to me. And thanks also to all of you, wherever you are in the world, for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you feel moved to do so, please give us a star rating and maybe even a review on your podcast app. It only takes you a second, and it really helps with spreading the word. So until next time, I'll say thanks again, and sail fast, everyone.